one short for a quorum, so we won't officially call it till we have somebody else report, and we'll do minutes after that as well. But our esteemed chair, Mr. Representative Mariani here, decided that the gavel was too heavy today. So I will be leading us, I guess, and trying to formulate a great discussion on a topic that's important to all of us, and that is QCOM. Many of us have heard this testimony from the Office of the Legislative Auditor yesterday in K-12 Ed Finance, but hopefully there were some new or additional questions that were formulated through that process yesterday that then could be asked today. So we are going to start out then with the Office of the Legislative Auditor. We have Jim Nobles and Judy Randall with us, and they are going to stop at slide 14. I just wanted to kind of note that, but they are not going to go into their actual application recommendations and things. They're going to stop at that point, but we'll definitely take any questions about their recommendations or any questions that you might have about what they reported in their findings that way. So with that, I will pass it over to Jim Nobles and Judy Randall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, and some of you do look familiar and have heard this presentation before. But I think yesterday, both in the Senate and the House, we really started a very good discussion about this issue. So I'd like to kind of start where we left off yesterday with many of you, and that is pointing out that there are many initiatives and programs and ideas to try to improve education. And I think for most people what that means is improve student performance. And I'm sure all of you on this committee and as citizens and as people involved in education have heard many of these ideas over the years. Reduce class size, early childhood education. Some have even suggested that the whole enterprise of public education needs to be transformed by more choice, and so we have charter schools and post-secondary options. And so I think everybody in this room has some idea of what they think would work. And I think that those ideas come from our own experience as students, as parents, as people who talk to teachers and administrators. And I think all of that insight is valid and valuable. But it does seem that we also want some confirmation from evaluations, from statistics about what works. And as we said yesterday, that's sometimes very difficult to deliver in a social science statistical sense, to take all the variables into consideration and tell you, yes, we are certain this works. Nonetheless, we have to make choices, and we have to move forward with the best information that we have. And the administration has moved forward with its proposal, and some of you heard yesterday the commissioner say that the administration believes from research and from experience that the most important thing for improving education, for getting better student performance, is getting better teachers, getting teachers that are highly qualified and competent in the classroom, and that QCOMP will deliver that. It will deliver that by improving the nature of teacher training and development, and it will deliver that by changing the structure of pay, rewards, incentives, in other words, change the steps and lanes approach. That is their position, and at the request of the legislature, we went out last year and delivered the report this year on QCOMP. And again, we can't tell you for sure from statistics that QCOMP will deliver better student performance. But we can tell you what we often have as the next best thing, and that is the insights and opinions of the people who are closest to the situation, namely teachers and administrators. So we surveyed them, and we can tell you what they think. We can also tell you who is participating in QCOMP and who is not and why. We can also tell you quite a bit about the way the program has been administered. But I think you face now, in this legislative session, some very difficult choices, in part because QCOMP, whether you agree with it or not, it does come with a cost, $49 million in the current fiscal year. And the governor has proposed to make it statewide, and so if we go with this model, it will cost more. But again, the administration, I think, is convinced that this will be the way forward to deliver better student performance. And you have to consider that, and again, I think our assessment of QCOMP as it is now will help you in that assessment. So, Mr. Chairman and members, if I could now ask Ms. Randall to make an abbreviated presentation of our report.
Thank you, and I will officially call it to order because we are at quorum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Judy Randall, and again, I recognize many of you from yesterday afternoon. I'm with the Office of the Legislative Auditor, and I'm pleased to be here again today. Before I get started, I would like to acknowledge again my colleagues, David Kirchner and Mary Robinson, sitting there in the audience, for all their hard work on the evaluation. We have three key findings that I'll touch on, I think, one of them here today, and then if there's questions on the others, we can certainly get to them. The first is that the effects of QCOMP on student achievement can't be adequately measured using the existing data. The next is that the department's application review process has several weaknesses, the biggest one being that different applicants have been held to different standards depending on when they applied to the program. And the third is that not all QCOMP participants are subject to regular oversight by the department. Before I talk about some of those findings, I'm going to just kind of give a big overview again of QCOMP and a kind of a refresher on how the program works. QCOMP was created during the 2005 special legislative session, and the first participants, which are school districts and charter schools, entered the program that fall. So the program was put into law mid-summer 2005, and just a couple months later, the first charter schools and school districts started in the program. QCOMP is a voluntary program, and teachers and administrators come together jointly develop an application, jointly implement their program. A lot of attention with QCOMP is focused on the merit pay and alternative compensation aspects of it, but there's actually much more to it. There's a very large professional development aspect of QCOMP. There are five components, and I'll touch on each one briefly. The first is career advancement opportunities. Through QCOMP, school districts and charter schools provide career advancement opportunities for their teachers that allow them to retain a presence in the classroom. So this is often things such as being a mentor teacher or a lead teacher of a team of teachers, or perhaps acting as an evaluator where they go in and observe other teachers and help them refine their skills. The next component is professional development, and QCOMP professional development must take place on-site and during the school day. So it's not a one-day workshop at a conference center. Instead, it's embedded during the school day. And I know we spoke a little bit yesterday afternoon about that might look like professional learning communities or learning circles that take place on a weekly or biweekly basis. The third component are teacher evaluations. And under QCOMP, every teacher, a probationary or tenured teacher, must be evaluated multiple times each year. The Department of Education requires every QCOMP teacher to be evaluated three times every year.
We have a question here, Representative Twelve.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just would like to clarify because my school district instituted professional learning communities before we became a QCOMP school. And I just want to be very clear that they are not the same. I am not compensated with QCOMP for being a part of a professional learning community. And I just want to make sure they're two very separate things.
Mr. Chair, Representative, absolutely. And in many school districts that are not in QCOMP, they do professional learning communities and have done it long before QCOMP. But in many QCOMP school districts, they use professional learning communities as their professional development piece. So I think I absolutely agree it can happen outside of QCOMP. Many QCOMP school districts do use that as a big form of their professional development.
Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you get to the QCOMP components and retaining presence in classroom, mentors, lead teachers, and so forth, in the report that the Star Tribune did, they indicated that out of a couple thousand teachers that are getting QCOMP, only 22 of that total body didn't receive it. Doesn't that sort of fly in the face of this, of being mentors, lead teachers, and so forth? I mean, it sounds like there are steps in the teaching profession as opposed to everyone getting it, everyone who's a class teacher.
Ms. Randall?
Mr. Chair, Representative, first I do want to clarify that the Star Tribune article on Sunday that you're referring to was their own investigation and not our work. But my understanding of reading that, and it's consistent with what we saw, is, and I'm about to get to, in fact, I'll just go there now so you can see it, the two last components, which are about the pay. And there's kind of two buckets, in a way, of the performance, the way the performance pay works. There's one where It's the performance-based pay, the 60% of salary increase, and it's almost like a bonus. It's often paid in the form of a stipend. The second part is the alternative salary schedule, where teachers cannot advance on the salary schedule simply due to years of experience. What I believe the Star Tribune article was talking about is that, you know, 99% of the teachers were receiving that salary increase no matter what. And that's kind of referring to that alternative salary schedule aspect of it. And that would be consistent with what we saw. Typically, again, and what we saw in a school district, and I'm kind of jumping here to that last bullet there on the salary schedule, it would still look like a steps and lanes grid. But rather than moving a step due to a year of experience, they would move a step because they had performed well on several performance evaluations. So most teachers are advancing in their salary that way. A far fewer number of teachers are receiving the bonus pay, the performance-based pay stipend. So there's kind of two pieces there. And then the career advancement aspect is yet another way to receive performance pay. So, I mean, maybe even there's three types of performance pay. There's the salary schedule, which you don't get automatically anymore, but you get because you've done well in a performance review, and that most teachers are getting. And we asked this in our questionnaire. We sent a questionnaire to all school districts and charter schools in the state, and we heard that from 99% of those that are in the program. So we heard a lot of people didn't answer this question about the performance pay, but from what we heard from the questionnaire and what we heard on our site visits, was consistent that a high percentage of teachers are getting the salary schedule type of increase, but a far fewer number are getting the performance pay bonus payment, and then the career ladder opportunities are yet another form of stipend typically. That was probably much more than you wanted, but
Representative Newton,
just to follow up, Mr. Chair, thank you. Does that mean that in the proposals that are being sent to the Department of Education, that the districts requesting QCOMP are asking for three different buckets of money to use specifically? Because my understanding is that every district that makes an application has a somewhat different twist on it. And from what you're saying, it sounds like there are three specific areas. So if you could clarify that, please.
Ms. Randall?
Mr. Chair, Representative, when an applicant submits an application, they have a budget that they outline how they're going to use the QCOMP funding. They do identify how much they're going to pay people who are in those career advancement opportunities. So a lead teacher might get a $1,500 stipend for that year, and a mentor teacher might get a $500 stipend for that year. Again, it's going to vary based on the program. And then they'll also include in their budget a line item for the performance-based pay aspect. QCOMP is not going to pay for all of it. So a district will still use a lot of its general fund money, for example, for the salary schedule aspect of it. There's also going to be line items in the budget to cover substitute teachers, because a lot of the professional development takes place during the school day. So some of the money is going to be used for release time. Some of the money might be used for training material. Some of it might be used for additional testing so they can see how the students are growing and trying to tie student achievement to teachers. So there's a pretty detailed budget that outlines how they plan to use the money. And, yeah, those different buckets are identified to some extent. And I know there's representatives from the department here if you want to explore that further.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just add to that question, because I think the Star Tribune article raised an important issue. It was very visible, certainly, and I think raised some questions and doubts in people's minds. I would just add this perspective as someone who manages an office with a performance pay system myself, and dealing with other organizations in state government and other places that have those, I think you have to ask the question, what was or would be the appropriate variation in the distribution of performance pay? I mean, you're taking a snapshot, but it's very possible that any given year you did have very high performance or consistent performance among teachers or among evaluators and auditors during one period of time that you're assessing. So should it be great variation or little variation? I think you really have to know the facts in each situation to make that determination. And the Star Tribune was making, I think, a kind of big generalization.
Thank you. Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think you just bring up a really good point of knowing some of the facts that go into these evaluations, and that's what I'd just like to spend a little bit of time on and know more of the facts. This teacher evaluation, I have a couple of questions. Who evaluates the teachers? What kind of training do they get prior to evaluating teachers? And then what is the tool that they use to evaluate the teachers? And do we have a common tool across the state, or is that a situation where each district develops their own tools?
Ms. Randall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. I will direct you to pages 24 and 25 in the report where we provide some of those answers, but I'd also be happy to say them. By law, the evaluations have to be conducted by a team and by a locally trained team. So what happens is when an applicant submits an application to the department, they identify the criteria that they're planning to use to evaluate the teachers. Many school districts have chosen to use the Charlotte Danielson model or some type of model, which is a rubric which shows different skills that a teacher may have, you know, different skills that a teacher may use in delivering the classroom curriculum, and then different standards which would show, you know, this person is at a basic level, this person is at a more proficient level, this person is at an expert level. So whether they use Charlotte Danielson or some model of that.
Can you move over?
I got that.
This happened yesterday.
So they use this rubric, this, you know, this set of standards which some districts adapt and some districts create their own, but many of them follow the same model. And then the evaluators are often other teachers or administrators, or oftentimes it's an opportunity for one of those career advancement opportunities. So it's a teacher that is designated as somebody who's going to be doing classroom observations, and they are to be locally trained. So they should have received training on the standards that are going to be applied. And I think a big emphasis of QCOMP is the transparency, so that teachers know what they're going to be evaluated against. And also I would just reiterate that the application was developed jointly. So the teachers and the administrators have all kind of agreed on these evaluation standards and how they're going to be applied and who's going to be conducting them.
Any follow-up, Ms. Dietrich?
No, thank you.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate Representative Dietrich's question, because I think it you know, kind of properly helps to focus this committee, I think, in terms of the deeper policy questions that should be vetted here. And I guess my question is similar to that. As I understand it, unless I don't always pay close attention, I apologize, but Ms. Randall, as I understand it, your response is based on the third component in terms of explaining the teacher evaluation framework. There are these other two components, though, the school-wide student achievement and other measures of student achievement. And so what I'm trying to reconcile is your overall audit basically says that, you know, there's inconclusive evidence in terms of the effectiveness of, you know, at least in the broad statewide effectiveness of student achievement of this particular method of teacher performance pay, student achievement, and evaluation framework. So my question is, what were you able to ascertain from participating districts about key elements that they were using to attempt to answer one and two? And whether any of those were common, standards that were used across districts. I just want to dive a little bit deeper into that, you know, that one and two part, in terms of forming any kind of basis for their decisions to be able to do the performance pay element. And it seems to me, and I'll just editorialize a little bit, that you know, it's one thing to be able to make some conclusions about the effectiveness of student achievement relative to a teacher's work, it's another thing to do that and then base someone's pay, their livelihood, on that. And I think that's kind of where the big national debate has been on this issue. I think, you know, that sort of rises to a more higher standard, it seems to me, of this. And I perhaps, Dr. Noble, I think that's partly what you were saying at the very beginning. You know, I think there has to be a very deliberate, prudent, careful application of those first two standards, because there are fundamental questions of fairness related to a person's livelihood that's at stake here, which is slightly different than the other desires that we have, which is just to drive student achievement regardless of pay. But anyway, I'm saying too much. I guess my first question has to do with what were you finding from districts were being used in terms of answering one and two, and was there some kind of common agreement of that across the districts that were participating?
Ms. Randall.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, thanks for the question. Let me just explain that first bullet a little bit more, and then I can dive into your specific questions. So that the fourth component is performance-based pay, and by law, 60% of the teacher's salary increase must be tied to these three factors. And the local school district or charter school can decide what percentage of each of these factors is tied to the salary. So they can decide how much weight each one is given. And I will direct your attention to page 28 in the report, and it shows kind of the average of across the participants about how much they are linking each of these components to those, to the salary. So about half of salary increases on average are tied to the teacher evaluation piece. And then around 20%, a little bit less and more, are tied to these other two measures, the student achievement piece. The first point here, the school-wide student achievement, is student achievement is measured on a standardized assessment and as against annual goals. So what happens is the participant, and I'm just going to say a school district, but it could be a charter school, the school district comes together each year and they set school-wide goals. This is at the school level. And it has to be a standardized assessment. Many school districts use either MCAs or the NWEAs and use like a RIT score. And they come together and they identify what they think is a rigorous but attainable goal for that year. And actually in the report also I give kind of an example on page 27. We kind of lay out what it might look like we just made this up. It's not any one particular district, but this is how it often looks and it's representative. So they might say, okay, 25% of your performance-based pay is going to be linked to this goal, and our goal is that, you know, we're going to see a 3 percentage point increase in the number of our middle school students who are proficient on the MCA to reading assessment. That's an example of one. There could be lots of other ones. You could say, you know, we want a 2 point increase on our average RIT score. You know, there's lots of different ways to do that. And there's a process that the local schools do, so the local district does, and then they actually have to submit their annual goals to the department every year, and the department has to approve them. So we have stuff to say in the report about that. They've struggled quite a bit between the department and the participants in figuring out what are appropriate goals. And the department has established what they call a SMART framework, so that the goals are strategic, measurable, attainable, rigorous, and time-bound. That's the SMART acronym. And there's been a lot of refinement over the past couple of years as to how that works in the department. I think it's going to continue to work on that. So there's commonality, certainly, because it's tied to the same few tests, standardized tests, and they tend to be, it's a percentage point increment growth based on what the school thinks makes sense for them. And then this number two, the other measures of student achievement, those don't have to be based on standardized assessments. So you will see more variation on what that might mean. It could be portfolio work. It could be grades. It could also be how a teacher's, and it's usually tied to a teacher's own students. So the first point is school-wide student achievement. The second one is the teacher's own students. And that could be how the teacher's own students did on the MCAs, or it could be how the teacher's own students did on portfolio work or grades. And that one, again, is locally decided upon. So I'd say there's more commonality on that first part, the school-wide student achievement, because there's also more requirements on what that must look like. The second one provides a little more flexibility, I think, at the local level. Does that answer the question?
Mr. Randall, yeah, I think it does. Are you able to tell us what percentages of schools are using NWEA versus MCA as one of the measurements to address this first point?
Ms. Randall?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murray, I don't have a firm number. We don't have that statistically, you know, counted out. It seems like a pretty even split in my mind, and I don't know if the department, I don't see Ms. King there, they don't, I'm getting a no, we don't have better information from them. So I saw both MCAs and NWEAs. There was occasionally a few other tests, but it was really mostly those. I will add that it's not always clear which standardized assessments the department will accept. They'll definitely accept MCA2s and NWEAs, but if a school district wants to use another standardized assessment, sometimes they face some resistance in demonstrating that it's as normalized and standardized and meets the criteria the department has. So we had some recommendations to the department on that aspect.
And Mr. Chair, just a quick editorial, and this was probably more directed at Representative Briner and my colleague here, that, you know, perhaps, you know, because we worked together on the SWOT model concept as one of multiple measures for assessing school performance. It seems to me that perhaps that school might be helpful and instrumental in as a possible use for addressing that first point.
Thank you, Representative Mariano.
I'm trying to flush out my comments.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Representative Newton had a question, and then we'll Representative Brenner.
Thank you, Mr. It's more of a comment, and it appears to me, because of the small number of teachers that are denied QCOMP in the system, that it's used more as a measure of punishment for that handful of teachers that aren't performing up to whatever level that the school would anticipate. And the other thing is, it just seems that I spent a career in the military, and we had a system called proficiency pay. And it worked very well when you were doing lower-ranking individuals, the E3s and E4s in the service. But when you got up to the senior officers and the senior NCOs, if they didn't get a rating that was at the highest level of 7 all the way across on all the criteria, there was something wrong. And I'm just afraid that in a system like this, you're either having principals doing the evaluations, maybe in some of the smaller schools. They want to keep harmony, so they're going to make sure that everyone gets the additional pay. And if you have other teachers doing the evaluations, they're working in these professional learning communities. They don't want to cause problems with their fellow teachers. So it's a system that's, I think, that's designed for failure in the long run. That's my personal opinion of it.
Thank you, Representative Newton. And I guess I would add to that as a question, Ms. Randall. Those who were denied payment under one of these reasons, is there a generalization that you can make about why they were denied, what purpose it was, or what they were not achieving in order to receive that compensation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would say a large number of teachers are not receiving the pay associated with school-wide student achievement because, you know, if one school doesn't make their 2 percentage point increase in their MCA2s, then none of those teachers are receiving that portion of the pay. So that was the largest reason why an individual teacher would not receive at least part of the performance pay. In terms of not meeting the performance evaluations to a sufficient degree so that they move a step, I think that would be on an individual basis. You know, I visited one charter school, I believe, where, you know, they had one teacher that wasn't performing where they thought that teacher should be. And after a couple of rounds of them not moving their step, this is a little bit of my recollection, so, you know, I'm hesitant to say, and this is being recorded and all that. So anyway, makes me a little nervous. But anyway, the general thought was, you know, that maybe this wasn't the right spot for that person. But that there was a lot of kind of trying to work with that person to get them where they needed to be so that the alternative salary schedule aspect of the pay was accomplished. So again, I say most folks aren't making the performance pay on those three factors, really the first two factors up there.
Thank you, Representative Briner.
Mr. Chairman, can I just add, because I think Representative Newton really raises some key points about what is the management philosophy behind the performance pay system. Is it just a system of rewards, or is it a system of punishment and rewards? And I think you'll get people who differ on that. But I think the question, too, is what do you want to do in St. Paul to make your vision of what that ought to be present in school districts? Or do you want to leave it to school districts, principals, superintendents, school boards to decide to emphasize one or the other or both? I mean, that's what I think QCOMP presents to you as legislators. I think a lot of you come from local school districts as teachers, administrators, school board members, and you know what you want there. But the question for you here in St. Paul is, do you get down to mandating and requiring that there should be some distribution of pay, that you should see 0 to 6% for it to be implemented correctly? Or do you want to leave that decision to local officials and say whatever they decided was correct because they know the facts of their situation best?
Thank you. Representative Brenner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment on Representative Mariani's suggestion that the growth measure might fit the criteria under number two. I would say that it definitely has that capacity, but I'm very reluctant at this point to assign any role to the growth model in terms of compensation, whether it's for QCOMP or performance pay. And the reason I say that is I think it's one of the mistakes we made as a nation with NCLB, and that's while we were trying to assess the use of the measures we implemented before we had research data. And I think we need some time to see what the growth measure will tell us about schools, and then we need to reconvene a group of experts to look at that data and see what we've learned, and then ask the question about the appropriateness of its use in a compensation system.
Very well stated. Representative Dietrich.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can't agree with Representative Brenhart anymore, and those of you who were in education finance yesterday, I made that comment of, is now the time to be expanding this statewide? And this is a huge policy shift for the state of Minnesota to be investing this much money and a certain portion of it on property taxes to fund teacher compensation. And the question is the time right now? And once we have, and I know Commissioner Segrin responded back to me, she said, well, we have things like compensatory ed, and nobody has assessed that, and yet we continue to fund that each and every year. Well, there are some of us that believe compensatory funding is not fair to all districts and to all students. And what is, once it is there and it is statewide, how easy is it going to be to take it away? And which legislature will have the stamina to do that? So I cannot emphasize enough where I come from on this subject. I think we need more data, and I think we need to know what we are measuring and why, and what results are we going to get from it. Long sentence.
And that is definitely within there, too, about the statement of many districts were hesitant to see of whether or not that money was going to be there over the long period of time because they didn't want to grow accustomed to those dollars and then have it taken away from
right.
them. Go ahead, Ms. Randall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think we've covered the slide adequately, so I'm going to just keep going.
No,
I didn't mean it. Obviously, let's keep going. A refresher on QCOMP funding. Just to remind you that charter schools and school districts that are in the program are eligible for up to an additional $250 per pupil. It's a mix of state and local funding. Under the current law, it's $190 of state funds, and then the school districts can choose whether or not to levy the additional $70 in local funds. If they do not levy, they're still eligible for the full state amount. This shift, or this balance between state and local funding, is slated to shift next fiscal year to be $169 in state funding and then $91 in local funding. In fiscal year 2009, it's estimated the state will spend $49 million on QCOMP, and this is about 80% of the funding that the legislature has authorized. Let me talk a little bit about participation. Currently, there are 72 school districts and charter schools in the program. 13% of school districts, or 44 school districts, and 18% of charter schools, 28 charter schools. And the largest concentration of participants is in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. Here on the map, I think really shows you where they're located. The darker red school districts are the larger school districts with over 5,000 students enrolled. The lighter pink color are medium-sized school districts with 1,500 to 5,000 students. And then the small gray ones are the smaller school districts with 1,500 students or less. The yellow dots are charter schools. You can really see that participation is dominated by larger school districts in the metropolitan area. Now, one of the things we did is send a questionnaire out to all school districts and charter schools in the state, including those not in the program. And one of the questions we asked those not in the program is, why aren't you in the program? $260 per pupil, it's a lot of money to leave on the table. And we heard a number of different answers through our questionnaire, but a couple bubbled up to the top. The first one was teacher reluctance, and this was the most frequently cited reason about why school districts didn't participate in the program. It was either teacher indifference or teacher opposition to the program. The other reason we heard a lot was uncertainty about funding, and this is what the chair was just referring to. Non-participants were worried that the legislature, whether the legislature was going to continue the funding or not. School districts and charter schools in the program already are also worried about whether the legislature is going to continue the funding, and they're also worried about the possibility of the balance between the state and local sources shifting to have a heavier burden on the local levy. We also heard some unique concerns from the smaller districts in particular about the time commitments that are necessary to develop a program, to apply to QCOMP, and to implement the program. We visited one small school district in South Central Minnesota that is in the program, but they said the only reason why they were able to do it is because the teachers and administrators that developed the application did so on the weekends and in the evenings. And so the school district wouldn't have been able to pay for their time to get the program and plan up to speed. All right, so that's the end of the overview. And then I was going to touch briefly on the first big finding, which was that the effects of QCOMP on student achievement can't be adequately measured with existing data. And there are a number of reasons for this. First, as we've discussed, the program is relatively new. It's only been in place for 3 full years, and there are relatively few participants. Of course, only 72 that are in now, but only 11 school districts or charter schools have been in the program for 3 full years. So the data are limited in part because there are few participants, and then in part because, as we've been discussing, the student growth data, the data on student achievement growth, it's not where the state needs it to be yet to do this type of analysis. Additionally, QCOMP is just one initiative in a school, and there's lots of other things happening in a school. There's class size reduction initiative, there's ID, there's changing the curriculum, there's all sorts of things that are constantly changing and moving in a school. So to disentangle the effects of all those things and isolate those that are just associated with QCOMP is not statistically possible, especially with the limited data. Also, right now the program is voluntary, and that means that school districts and charter schools that have chosen to participate in the program are likely different in significant ways than those that have chosen to not participate in the program. So if you were able to identify effects of QCOMP on student achievement in the participating district, that doesn't mean that they would necessarily be replicated in the school districts and charter schools that have chosen for now to not participate in the program. We also looked at the national research on similar types of programs that are in place across the country. There are a few other school districts across the country that have implemented programs that try to marry performance pay and professional development. And our research and our review of that literature showed that this really inconclusive data. The research is also inconclusive on the links between these types of programs and student achievement. Now, we couldn't measure it statistically, but one thing that we did do is we did these surveys of school districts and charter schools, and we also did surveys of a sample of teachers across the state. And based on those responses, there were a couple of main findings there. One is that, in general, administrators are more positive than teachers about the program. And secondly, both administrators and teachers are more positive about the professional development aspects of the program than the performance pay aspects of the program. So here's a couple of the questions that we asked them. This one is about the effects of QCOMP. So we couldn't measure it statistically, but this is people who are in the program, teachers and administrators in QCOMP programs, what their perceptions are of the effects of QCOMP. So here we ask them the extent to which they agree or disagree that QCOMP will lead to increases in students' performance on standardized tests at their school. And here you can see 81% of administrators agreed or strongly agreed with that, while one-third of teachers agreed or strongly agreed that QCOMP will lead to basically to increase test scores. And 30% of teachers disagreed or strongly disagreed with that statement. We also asked them whether QCOMP has improved classroom teaching at their school. And there it's a little different. Administrators largely had the same views, but teachers were more likely to agree with this statement. So 43% of teachers that responded said that QCOMP has improved classroom teaching at their school. So these questions are about the broad effects of QCOMP. We also asked them about the individual components in QCOMP. And this one regarding professional development, we asked them the extent to which they agree that QCOMP has improved teacher professional development in their school. And here 90% of administrators and 56%, over half of teachers agreed or strongly agreed with this, that QCOMP has improved their professional development. Now when we asked them about performance pay, though, the answers were different. Here the question is worded a little differently, so I just want you to take note of that. This is, what effect has linking teacher pay to student test scores had on your school? And over half of teachers said that linking teacher pay to test scores has had a negative effect, negative or strongly negative effect on their school. Administrators were more mixed. 39% thought it had a positive or strongly positive effect. So this was linking teacher pay to the test scores. When we asked them about linking teacher pay to the evaluations, the teacher evaluations, it was a little more favorable. A third of teachers thought this had a positive or strongly positive effect, and 58% of administrators thought it had a positive or strongly positive effect. You still have, you know, a significant number of teachers thinking it has a negative effect. Mr. Chair, I think that's where we decided to call it quits.
Yes, and we do have a panel of teachers and representatives from school districts that are on QCOMP here to, you know, answer some of those questions that you might have. Representative Swales had a question.
Thank you. It's more of a comment, Mr. Chair, and that is that as we are considering what to do in this fiscal year and the stress that it's creating, I'm very troubled by the fact that there is not conclusive evidence that this is increasing student performance, and yet we have conclusive evidence that investments in early childhood education and all-day kindergarten does increase student performance, and I just would like for us not to forget that there is sound data out there that points to those improvements, and it's an investment in children that I think in the long term could be more beneficial. I am a QCOMP teacher. I have benefited from the dollars. I don't deny that. I've enjoyed the collegiality that it's created in my school. But in terms of overall investment and what I think will truly make a difference in the performance of children in school, I would rather go with data that is more conclusive.
Thank you, Representative Swales. Representative Dietrich.
Representative Swales.
Thank you. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as with most of my colleagues around the table this morning, this is more of a comment than a question. I very much appreciate the last set of slides, because yesterday in finance I was thinking, listening to the presentation and thinking about it, and came up with two myths I think that are tied to QCOMP. One is that we can connect directly QCOMP to student performance. And I think, Ms. Randall, you did it well in terms of both the inadequacy of the data system, to paraphrase, but you're nodding, but also there's too many levers going on, and I think maybe more directly is the myth that pervades the legislature, and I think many of the conversations about if we do this we'll improve student performance, that student performance is something that if we just turn this dial or flip this switch, it will lead directly to this improvement. And I think that's a myth that somehow we need to struggle with. I think the other underlying myth around QCOMP is that the one missing component in improving student performance was teacher pay. And that if you just offer to pay me more, I'll get off my duff and get to work. And I, as a teacher, I think that's offensive. But I also think it's a ham-handed understanding of human motivation. And hopefully in the education field we'd have a little more, little finer grained understanding of motivation, and that Representative Swales certainly appreciates the money, but probably didn't go into teaching for the money, because if she did, it was a bad decision. ditto my fellow teaching colleagues around the table.
Is that why you went into the legislature? Yeah.
a cascading set of bad decisions. But, you know, all that said, I'm still generally positive on QComp in the change in the culture of my profession. Both my children attend what's been a QComp school in Minneapolis, and that school scores above the state average on the MCA2s. Is there a direct correlation? Apparently not.
We don't know.
But I think, you know, some of the opportunities to change the culture of teaching are in fact positive, and maybe it's only positive for the teachers, and that will later leak into the students' experience. But maybe we need to struggle with some of the mythology that's underlying QComp as we look at it going forward.
That's why I think it'd be nice now to invite our QComp schools. It would be Jody Olson, Dave O'Connor, and John Steffes from some schools that are currently using QComp within their districts. And I think some of our questions, then we'll be able to focus on that, and we'll get to the individuals that have those questions. And we can still pose those to the legislative auditors as well. But I'd like to invite them down as we're transitioning. Representative Peterson, did you have a comment, or was there a question for the auditors?
I had a question for the auditors.
Representative Owen Miller, did you have a question for the auditors or a comment? Okay. Yeah, let's hold on then. If we can get back to them, we will.
Do you have a comment or is it a question?
All right. Well, thank you for being here. We have a kind of a rule here that you need to state your name and your position for the record. And then I know you guys were posed with the question of what is the impact on student achievement and teacher development within your district by having QComp. So go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Jody Olson, president of the Wayzata Education Association. As noted in the legislative auditor's report, it is hard to disentangle the effects of QComp on student achievement from other initiatives. We've been in the program 2.5 years, so we don't have the data that's gathered over time that would give us our valid information. However, because of QComp, we have the opportunity to focus on data and its relationship to instructional strategies and student learning more than ever. Teachers and administrators are examining student assessment in a new way. Teams and data coaches are now working all year to identify strengths and weaknesses of particular curricular areas and developing plans to address any additional support that's indicated by the data. They can more easily identify the progress made by students who receive particular targeted services or interventions to determine if they are or were effective. And teachers are developing professional development plans that will specifically relate to the site goals and support those. We have always used assessment to inform instruction, but we have become much more focused as teams, departments, sites, and as a district. As one teacher stated in one of our surveys, usually during team meetings we have enough time to brainstorm some ideas, share examples, and do a little planning. But to be able to have the time to actually analyze data and discuss why we are teaching the material is refreshing. The impact on professional development has been dramatic. The QComp program provided opportunities for us to develop the Academy for Wayzata Educators. Teachers can enroll in classes or study groups that are taught by district staff. All classes align with our site goals and must define in the application process how the content will affect student achievement. This program has been a tremendous success for us. Last year, we had 19 courses and 46 study groups that would include 12 hours of class time and then 3 hours of reflection and implementation. 91% of our staff enrolled in courses that met outside of the school day, and of that staff, 98% reported satisfaction with the course content, the reflection, and the time to implement strategies back in their classroom. Another example of our professional development that has been powerful has been the training for our peer coaches. They have undergone intensive training in the areas of instructional strategies, the purpose of reflection and coaching, summative and formative assessments, and greater reliability. The peer coaches will be returning to the classroom on a cycle with new learning and then working with their new colleagues and team members as new peer coaches are hired. Participating in the peer coaching process really enables all the teachers to acquire enhanceable skills as well. In response to a question on that survey regarding the level of satisfaction with the entire peer coach process, a teacher wrote that the discussions with my peer coach have been both challenging and affirming. Being able to think critically with my coach enables me to look closely at myself and my skills. And another stated that being able to meet with a colleague and discuss ideas, to be able to put our heads together, has been a powerful experience. Our peer coach is an incredible person who inspires you to do more than you could ever imagine, so our students benefit tremendously as well. In that same survey, 95% of our staff has reported satisfaction with the peer coaching process. This cycle of new learning and sharing it with others is invaluable. The benefits around professional development provided the opportunity to reflect on instructional practices, receive feedback. Teachers are continuing to grow professionally and incorporate their new learning back into their teaching. And teachers no longer work in isolation as they are collaborating with others on how to best meet cycles, improve instructions, and ultimately improve student learning. Participation in the QCOMP program has been a significant shift in our district, and I've personally been humbled by the risks that our teachers have been willing to take to make the shift most meaningful for our district. I'm grateful for the opportunity that it's provided for our district, and I'm very proud of our teachers for their work and commitment. As a classroom teacher for 21 years, I can tell you that even if you have a room full of kids, teaching can be a very isolating experience. So reducing this isolation through the QCOMP program frees all of us to reflect, set goals, and think creatively about student learning. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. We'll go on to Mr. O'Connor.
Oh. My name is Dave O'Connor. I'm currently working for the Roseville Area Schools as a consultant for their QCOMP program. I've had 11 years experience as a classroom teacher, staff developer for a couple of years, principal for 9 years, and retired from the Roseville Area Schools as deputy superintendent 3 years ago. The question regarding the impact of QCOMP on student achievement, I would concur with what we heard during the discussion previous to this, that there are difficulties with the standardized measures to use that and draw conclusions regarding QCOMP, I think primarily because of the newness. However, I would expect that at the end of a longer period of time, and if we are able to sustain the efforts that have been put forth with QCOMP in the professional development area, it will pay off in higher student achievement. I think the assumption that we are operating under with QCOMP is that what we have the greatest ability to do is impact the quality of teaching. And if we impact the quality of teaching, the assumption would be we'd raise our student learning. Our district is a little bit unique, I think, from the QCOMP districts in that our negotiated agreement, which ends this year, allows us to implement QCOMP on a piecemeal basis. We have 11 possible sites in the Roseville Area Schools. 6 of those sites have voted to implement QCOMP. One site the first year, kind of a pilot system. After a year of experience, 3 additional sites voted to participate. This year we have 6 sites participating, so 6 out of our 11 sites. However, the 5 sites not participating are our largest sites, and so the majority of teachers in Roseville are not participating in QCOMP. But what it has allowed me to do is to look at, in the same district, what's different about professional development at the QCOM schools versus the non-QCOM schools. And there are some significant differences. Even though all of the schools in Roseville have professional learning communities and are working to increase the teacher collaboration, all of the schools submit annual student learning goals that are aligned to the district goal. And all of our schools are using standards of, they're using the Charlotte Danielson standards of professional practice for evaluation. The difference between the two is that the QCOM schools, the quality of the activities leading toward, more in-depth professional development and a higher quality of collaboration and more focus on student learning is evident. And it's there because of the, a couple of reasons. One of them, the additional resources that come to the QCOM schools, which we're able to use to hire and train peer facilitators. And they're different, our program is different than WISED is. But we have some quality control built into the training of our peer facilitators. We have quality control built into the fact that our professional learning communities focus on two specific areas of professional development. One is how is this collaborative team going to work together to achieve the student learning goal, and also how are you going to improve professional practice through performance evaluations by peers and reflection on the performance data. It's just allowed and provided more focus for our teachers. The pay component is an interesting one. I see it more as an incentive for the school district to focus on these areas that they, if without the pay, there still would be collaboration, but they're focusing on the fact that if our team accomplishes its professional learning goal, which is measured with some kind of student learning, will receive some amount of pay, and then there's the recognition and reporting of your results to your teammates. So I think the pay is more of an incentive to change and to try some new activities.
I think we had a question over here, Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say that Dave O'Connor is the reason that I like QCOM at all. Mm-hmm. And he invited me to participate in the one of the first Roseville schools effort in applying for QCOM. We both met at a liquor store between our houses on Rice Street. I was buying wine and he was buying beer. I got to see how this process can work at its best when you have a teacher's administrator like him leading the effort. And I got to see teachers who had voted against QCOM who participated in the team and ended up being the maddest teachers of all when the Department of Education denied the request on the first cut. You know, we got to see how this uneven implementation that the auditor refers to affected schools. But I think that the way that Mr. O'Connor did it with the team that did it was, you know, QCOM at its best. And I don't think we have it implemented that way all around the state, which is why we get these mixed reviews. But I am a supporter of keeping the schools that we have in it and keeping looking to see how it can work well. I don't think we should expand it because I don't think all schools are implementing it like has been done under Dave O'Connor's leadership. I think it can work at its best. Hopefully it will eventually, as he hopes to, show the student a performance that ties in with it. But because I've seen how he does it, I think it's very premature that the governor wants to just smash it through. because then you wouldn't have the process that each school went through in Roseville, which is what gives the synergy to have it work and have it work for students.
Thank you, Representative Grimey. Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate these this discussion that we're having today. I guess I'm feeling a little inclined to speak on behalf of my own district, who I believe is an extremely progressive district. We have worked over my tenure on the board and since on a high-quality staff development, I would guess probably very close to what I'm hearing in this presentation and by our speakers today. And we are a district that has and continues to use data and hold each school accountable with annual reports to the board that are very public about the growth on scores and the work that is happening in the building. Our district did not, our teachers actually brought a QCOMP proposal to the board. And I just want to say, I think, that for us, and it wasn't talked about from the earlier speakers with the auditors, the reason the board chose not to move ahead with QCOMP was we were loath to turn the money away because we know we have some of the best teachers in the state and they're not able to access the money that schools who have signed up for QCOMP are accessing, and we know our outcomes are as good as others across the state. But two things. One, there was no reform of steps and lanes, and I'm thinking perhaps this may have something to do with this unequal application of QCOMP, because in the proposal we had, steps and lanes would have remained as they were, and we would have just done a bonus pay, basically, for quality staff development and perhaps outcomes, and that's the second catch that we had. Without a growth model in a district like ours, we were apprehensive about using a school's ability to raise its scores or a teacher's ability to raise scores based on so many components that are outside the teacher's control, and a growth model, I think, would be more appealing. And so I guess, having listened to these, and I really appreciate the presentations, I would say I believe with or without QCOMP, Rochester's teachers and our school district still is making the progress we would hope all school districts, and I know all my teachers always work every day towards, and that perhaps we do need to slow down, as I heard Representative Brianerts and Dietrich speak to earlier, and wait for the growth model, wait till we have research before we move ahead. So. Thank you for that, Mr. Chair. I just felt like I needed to say we have a great school district. We do good things without QCOMP, but I would say our model in Rochester is very similar to the QCOMP school.
Thank you, Representative Norton. And I would echo that after we hear from Mr. Steffes, that if any of you want to comment on how you did alter your pay schedules and what were some of those ramifications of how that was implemented, what it was that you did, because I think that is something that all of us are intrigued by, is how did you meet those requirements and how did your teachers, your administrators, and others react to that?
My name is John Steffes. Thank you for having me here today. I teach second grade in southeastern Minnesota, La Crescent Holcomb School District. We've been with QCOMP since the start, and we've tweaked it along the way to make it work for everybody and to make sure that the focus is on students. And I have a couple positives about QCOMP. For instance, as a school, we've found that it's very data-driven. We can make sure that our instruction is focused. I heard you use the word focus a lot. And we have been able to focus our instruction towards site goals, towards individual goals which each teacher in our district has. And that, I think, makes a difference right there. It also focuses our staff development training. So when we do some staff development training, it's focused towards those building goals. It has forced me as a teacher, I hate to use the word forced, but to look at some of my students' data. For instance, when we take the NWEA test, we have language usage and math and reading, and I can look at the individual strands on there. And this will, when we talk about the, concern, is it really helping students' performance? I'll tell you what I did in my classroom and what I'm doing this year. I'm looking at my reading score, my NWEA test. I'm looking at my lowest strand, it's vocabulary this year. I am doing some research to learn some of the best ways to teach vocabulary to my students. I'm looking at my math, and I'm pulling some of those important vocabulary words that those students need to learn. Keep in mind, this is second grade. There's a lot of new vocabulary that students learn in second grade. Then, inside of my classroom, I'm doing some things that I've researched and learned about, read some books. I talked to my curriculum director. She gave me some materials to read and learn about. I have a vocabulary word wall based on some of the research I did about second grade vocabulary. I've taken some of my social studies vocabulary. I got a social studies vocabulary word wall. I have a math vocabulary word wall. Then, in the spring, I can look at that vocabulary strand, and I can see whether the growth in that vocabulary strand is higher than the growth in literature or reading comprehension, and see if some of those focus things that I did within my classroom increase student performance. And we'll find out in the spring. I did the same one last year, same individual plan, because I was able to look at that MWA test and see that, once again, that vocabulary strand needed to improve. And it did. I wrote up my little report, sent it in to my principal, and this is just one component of what we do for QCOM. And that vocabulary strand was the highest increase. A year before that, it was math computation, which was also our building site goal. So once again, we're focusing our instruction. And math computation, did some extra things, learned along the way, feel that I became a better teacher as I was learning, and my students, reaped the benefits of some of that extra work that I did, that extra research that I did inside of my classroom. So I know there's that, you know, does it really help with student performance? I say yes, because I see it every day in some of my students. There's more work involved. It hasn't always been embraced by our staff members, because there is extra work involved. But, you know, trying to be the best teacher I can be, I've realized, you know, here's a weakness. Let's make it a strength. Let's make it a high growth area. So I've done some of those things in my classroom. And I think, I don't want to say percentages, but two-thirds maybe embrace QCOM in our school. I think they realize it helps them to become better teachers, focuses their instruction, focuses their staff development, and you know, obviously when there's that strong focus, student achievement is gained.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Stevens. And can you react then to how it has altered the salary schedules within your districts and what you used to implement that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ann Wyzetta, we our focus within QCOMP has we've really concentrated on the growth and development of a teacher and their instructional strategies. And in the way that we reformed our salary schedule was, in order for a teacher to be able to receive this step, they needed to score 80% proficiency on the Charlotte Danielson model. Our teachers are evaluated during the school year with their peer coaches, and our intent is that the peer coaches do pre-conferences and post-conferences. It's a very structured model, but each teacher is able to identify areas of growth that the peer coach helps them to develop and helps them to brainstorm. You had asked, Mr. Chair, how the reaction of teachers and administrators. I would say when we presented this model, there was reluctance on the part of many of our teachers. This is the first time that many of our tenured teachers have been evaluated, have had someone in their classroom watching them teach. I think, as most of you know, as a tenured teacher, there aren't very many opportunities for evaluation. Like I stated previously, I've been teaching for 21 years, and since my probationary period, I have not been formally evaluated. So there was some hesitancy, but when we really promoted that this was about individual teachers and their growth, we overcame those hurdles. And I believe that our administrators were always supportive of reforming our salary schedule.
Our salary schedule is interesting because, again, we have half our teachers QCOM and half not on QCOM. The salary schedule is the base pay for all teachers in Roseville, and it remains to be a steps and lanes salary schedule. QCOM, if your site voted to become a QCOM school, your step improvement is called a performance increment. And that's based on an annual review by a licensed supervisor. And the judgment of the supervisor is based on the fact that he's collected data to support performance at the level of level of proficiency on the Danielson framework. In addition to that, though, the teachers at the QCOM schools have an opportunity, well, actually not an opportunity, but they're required to participate in three peer observations during the year and facilitated self-reflection and sharing their performance data with their collaborative team. If they complete that and their performance is judged by their team to be at the level of proficiency, they receive a portion of the performance of the performance pay, $1,100. If, for example, a teacher is judged to be performing below standard by their principal, there are some steps built in to protect the teacher. The first is principal has an opportunity to choose a low-level intervention called an awareness phase. And they meet with the teacher, and they use the Danielson framework to compare the principal's data with the descriptors in the framework. And it's really the principal letting the teacher know that, from my perception as your supervisor, this doesn't match proficient performance. The next, if the assumption is that that's going to change behavior. The next level, if performance is not changed, is called awareness level 2, and the teacher then has the opportunity to work with the union and the teacher rights group, and there's a schedule of more intensive evaluation set up specifically related to the area of deficiency, with a time frame established as to when the supervisor needs to judge that performance back at standard. No pay is impacted in the two awareness phases. If after that second step, performance remains below standard, the teacher is assigned to a teacher assistance team. At that point, the teacher loses their step increase and also loses their performance $1,100. Until they get back at standard, and then they can go back on the salary schedule. So we built some protections in that way. The other part of the pay is each site has a site achievement goal. If that's attained, there's a portion of pay. Each team is responsible for writing a team student learning goal that is aligned to the site goal. And if they attain their team learning goal, there's an additional portion of pay awarded. And each person in the school must complete a professional development plan that is worked on collaboratively with their team. And if that's judged to be done using a rubric, then they receive some pay. That's our pay system.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And a couple of questions, if I could. First, Mr. O'Connor, do you have a sense, maybe you've got a broader perspective, a statewide perspective, given your consulting role, do you have a sense that we have learned enough, that there's enough best practices to be shared, that we aren't creating a significant risk in rolling this out statewide? Is there enough learning to date?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think although I have to give the department credit for holding the school districts to the agreement that's been approved by the department, by performing annual peer reviews, I think there's such a variation in the implementation model that you can't really draw a conclusion by looking at one district's way of implementing. There is, I think, a wide body of research to support the best practices that are built into the components in the QCOM plan that the MDE requires each district to address. I'm very confident that, well, as it was cited by some of our teachers who are members this morning, those best practices are being implemented at sites whether they're QCOM or not. Mm-hmm. But to say roll it out on a statewide, I don't see that as being beneficial. I think it's really good right now that it's a voluntary program. Districts that can work together with their boards and teachers to negotiate an agreement that is satisfactory, and then the agreement though does really build some, I think, teamwork to move forward and implementing these best practices in a thoughtful, collaborative manner. I think if it's forced on school districts, I don't think that would happen.
Mr. Chair, can I follow up? Yeah, actually, a separate question for Mr. Steffes and Ms. Olson. And first, thank you, Atane. I know I speak for the entire committee and the entire state. We just love you guys and applaud you kind of taking the risk early on here in this adventure with QCOM to have jumped in and embraced it. I want to get back to a comment that Representative Newton made characterizing QCOM as kind of the ultimate levers of QCOM are punitive, and you described, I think, a real collaborative, collegial, joint teacher district initiative. And so I'm curious if you could comment on, you know, are there components here that do feel punitive to you, or is the net impact of it really kind of empowering and building the profession?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think at the beginning when we were rolling this out, I think there were teachers in our district that were concerned about the punitive nature. But I think because of the careful planning that we did in Wayzata, we took almost a year to research and decide if we wanted to pursue an application with QCOM, and then we took quite a bit of time in planning out the program. I think that was one of the things that we took into consideration, and we saw this as an opportunity to recognize teachers for the professional work that they were already doing. And so we really emphasized and built into our model the whole piece of professional growth. And I think that once teachers were working with their peer coaches and meeting, especially after the first year, I think for that small percentage of our staff that was concerned about the punitive nature, that dissipated. But it did take some concentrated efforts on the front end of it to make sure that the way we developed our program, we just focused on professional growth.
I'd like to invite Richfield down now so we can get them in and get their take on it, because they are not a QCOM school. So if we could have Mr. Holvey and Mr. Euler come on down. And let's get them in there, and then we'll have these other few questions that were coming out. So if you guys could remain here, and let's slide a couple chairs out there for our guest from Richfield. And if you can state your name as you're coming over, and if you could then, you know, add your comments about why your school district is not in QCOM, and any takes on your staff development and initiatives that you have. Go ahead, Mr. Holvey.
Racing in here. Sorry about that. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Craig Holtz, and I'm Director of Personnel and Administrative Services in the Richfield Public Schools, a former teacher in Richfield, and a former HR person up in the Anoka Hennepin Schools. And I'm here with Andy Euler, who's a social studies teacher at Richfield Middle School and president of Education Richfield, which is our local teachers' union. And we appreciate the opportunity to come and present to you collaboratively on this, because a lot of our work with the Alternative Teacher Professional Pay System has been a collaborative effort. We are pleased to be here to share information about our work as a district exploring alternative compensation models for teachers and more specifically the QCOMP program. We are a district that's been exploring alternative teacher professional pay systems, and I think I can finally say QCOMP since I've seen that on the auditor's report as well. So I'm going to stop with the long ATPPS or whatever. But we have not yet implemented it. Since 1999, teachers and administrators in Richfield Public Schools have been exploring different models for alternative compensation for teachers. We hadn't started right when QCOMP started looking at it. We started back in 1999 looking at the different models. And while that time, while there was interest in the plan, one of the things we found that there just wasn't the money to do it significantly and seriously in a meaningful way. This, along with a climate of budget cuts in 3 out of 6 years, caused the district to forego further conversations about it just because of the expense of the program. When the QCOMP was developed, we revived the committee and continued discussions as part of negotiations. As we evaluated the QCOMP program, we found some money to help support the program, but there were also requirements that we had difficulty fully understanding or knowing how the requirements would be interpreted as part of the application process. In fact, we had heard stories about how the requirements were changing from what had been previously approved for earlier applications. We were also concerned that the amount of funding would be insufficient to fully support the program and make meaningful changes in compensation to encourage employees to put more of their pay at risk. Nevertheless, we decided to move forward and develop a plan. Our concern about the amount of funding grew as we considered the staffing requirements that were being imposed in the application process and the administrative supervision that would be required to help teachers believe that they were really fully evaluated for their work instead of just a few moment-in-time observations during the course of the year. We also were aware that $1,000 to $2,000 may not be enough to convince some teachers to risk their perceived sure thing, even though we have contract language. We had already had contract language in our contract that allowed the district to withhold step advancement for performance. After looking carefully at what we were already doing to support our teachers and provide quality ongoing professional development, we found that much of what was being asked for was already in place in our district, and we also found some ways to subsidize this program with our current staffing. We worked to align as much of the program with what we were already doing. As we were working on the program, we were also aware of general concerns from employees regarding the changing culture to the organization, as well as the political environment under which this was implemented. Employees did not want to lose their sense of team and willingness to share because they were competing for money or because they were being evaluated by their peers. And we worked really hard to address this concern as we created a plan that we really felt encouraged the team support. The political environment during which this was created also caused great skepticism from staff members. The Minnesota School Report Card seemed to be designed to try to label us as a failing school, even though we were making more than 1 year's growth over a period of time for our students. In addition, state education mandates, along with corresponding funding, seemed to come and go with new administrations and changes in legislative powers. Quite simply, if this program wasn't going to really show the success we are having with our students, and if it was going to be another flash in the pan, it wasn't worth the perceived change it was proposing. We eventually came up with a plan with a few changes that met the MDE requirements and tried to address the plan-specific concerns of employees. Unfortunately, the plan was voted down significantly by teachers in Richfield.
And this is where we stepped in. We as a union stepped in and said, what if we did it more from our perspective, that if it was completely done from a teacher's perspective? And after Education in Richfield, teachers overwhelmingly voted down the QCOMP plan for 2007-2008. Education in Richfield created, with the district's approval, a new committee made up of a small number of members. We revised the plan and spent much time trying to educate our members on the advantages of the plan. The majority voted in favor of the plan. However, the past leadership of Education Richfield had changed the bylaws to require a supermajority vote in favor of an ATPPS plan. Most members of Education Richfield trust that the organization will lead them in a positive direction. The members' criticism of the plan was directed at the origin and requirements of the statute. Some examples of this criticism are as follows. For many teachers, QCOMP is perceived as a way for the governor to get public school districts to abandon their traditional teacher salary schedules. The statute requires it as part of the application for the additional QCOMP funds. The logic behind this concern is as follows. If about 40% of the state budget goes towards education, and public education's largest expenditure is staff, then it would be a target for legislators who would like to save money or not increase revenue. If the state could institute a measurement of public education that will only compensate some and tie it to test scores that do not always measure student growth, it will save money. Ultimately, the effort to dissolve traditional pay schedules and tie future increases in pay to student performance involves many factors over which teachers have no control, eliminates collective bargaining, and decreases the power of the union. Teachers in Richfield already do the vast majority of the work required in our QCOMP plan. Teachers that are already doing what is in the plan must spend extra time proving to others that they are in fact doing what they have already always done. For many, QCOMP seems like an added layer of unnecessary bureaucracy. For teachers who are already doing everything in their power to increase student performance, a new requirement that adds additional paperwork to teaching seems to belittle them as professionals. Another criticism of QCOMP is that it puts too much emphasis on testing. There are many teachers that teach valuable subjects but are not responsible for directly teaching math, reading, or writing. In addition, many support staff, such as counselors, social workers, and school nurses, don't believe their jobs can be evaluated in the same way as a classroom teacher's. Teachers of gifted and talented students wonder how much their student scores can improve, while other teachers wonder if certain students will attend school often enough to make significant gains. The range of circumstances in our students' lives that are beyond our control is significant. The teacher is the most influential person in the school building that can positively affect school or student achievement. However, any system that focuses only on the classroom teacher will fail to provide accurate data on student growth related to teacher effectiveness. Education Richfield presented QCOMP as a way for teachers to be compensated for the difficult work they do. Ideally, it would compensate them for their professional development and help students learn more effectively in the end. For many, the political context that presents public education as desperately in need of major changes, with the only solution being to fix the teacher, is misguided. Teachers have watched as our district has made cuts in multiple years while never recouping the money cut and then continuing to cut deeper. QCOMP is a way for teachers to make more money, and Education Richfield will always remain open to ideas that pay teachers more for the valuable work they do each day. However, QCOMP does not seem like a viable long-term alternative pay system, and many teachers do not believe that the political outlook that brought us QCOMP is ultimately concerned with improving public education.
If I may, just in closing, we continue to work collaboratively together on exploring alternative compensation, exploring the QCOMP program and moving forward that way. And certainly the success other districts have had has been something that's encouraged our teachers to look at it a little bit more because they see there's more trust that's built into it. And with that, we hope that the funding continues to be available to us as an option for the time that when we do decide to implement it, or if we do decide to implement it at that time. So we do hope that that stays in place as well.
I stood in many meetings where I was dealing directly with our staff and teachers from every building, and some of the arguments that I encountered last spring were extremely contentious. Teachers had different teachers had specific things that they just could not accept, and the more I've had a chance to think about it, it does seem punitive to a lot of teachers. We're certainly open to trying it. We would like to pursue it in terms of getting teachers more pay for what they're doing and for the staff development that we have. But we're finding in a district like Richfield that has always been way out front in terms of staff development that a lot of our teachers are saying, I do this. I already do this.
Thank you. Compelling testimony from all of our participants today, and I know we could continue to go until probably noon. So at this point, though, we need to move to accept the approve the minutes from our last. Do I have a motion from?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Reinert, all in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. All right. Well, I hope that we can continue this discussion, and I know we will as the session moves on. Thank you very much, and we are adjourned.